What can the health of the banks tell us about the health of the economy?
And China's economy grows as its villages shrink.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, January 17th.
Coming up, why you can't just compare GDP rates.
And the role of the economy in the South Carolina primary.
Plus, digging through financial mumbo jumbo.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We got earnings this morning from two banks. Citigroup says it made $1.2 billion last quarter. That's down 11% from a year earlier. Wells Fargo says it made $4.1 billion. That's up 20% from a year earlier. For more on this, let's bring in our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So make sense of these earnings for us.
Sure, absolutely. Well, what we saw was the banks are still profitable, which is great, but we have to take a close look at the fourth quarter, which is the last 3 months of the year. The banks who have reported so far, JP Morgan, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, all did really well until October. And then that's when the European debt crisis hit, and we saw the evidence of a credit crunch. And we're still seeing that evidence of a credit crunch. So that's what we have to keep an eye on going forward. And that's where the banks got hit.
Why the difference between these two banks this morning, with Wells Fargo doing better than it did a year earlier and Citi doing worse?
Sure. This is where you see the banks start to distinguish themselves in how they've chosen to run their businesses, right? So Citigroup still has significant investment banking. It serves companies and does a lot of trading. Wells Fargo focuses on businesses and consumers and lending. And right now, that's doing quite a bit better. Wall Street is suffering. You're seeing that where Citi and JP Morgan are concerned. And Wells Fargo is doing very well because the consumer is doing better.
And Heidi, what do these earnings tell us, if anything, about the health of the overall economy?
It tells us quite a bit. I mean, it does tell us that there's probably some strength left there. Lending still can go up and is going up at Wells Fargo and at JP Morgan. And it's also telling us that we have to be careful at the higher reaches of finance, where Europe is concerned, where debt is concerned, where investment banking is concerned. Because once that hits the banks, it can crawl throughout the economy. So we have to keep an eye there.
Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Now to the global perspective, and another market mover today, China. China's economy grew 8.9% last quarter, which is better than analysts expected, but still at its slowest rate in 2.5 years. The country's speedy growth has pushed millions of people to leave their homes in the countryside for better paying jobs in cities. And for the first time, according to national statistics, the number of urban dwellers has officially topped the rural population. Joining us now to help explain why we should all care is Professor Stephen Tsang. He's director of the China Policy Institute at the University of Nottingham in England. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So what does this mean for China's continuing economic growth? Is it going to speed things up or slow them down?
The shift of population from the rural area to the urban area means that the population in the urban areas are exposed to higher expectations, are exposed to information and exposed to consumerism. Now that they have seen what the urban areas have to offer, they want them. It makes them demand higher wages, and it also makes them demand more changes back home.
What are the economic implications of that to the rest of the world?
Well, with the Chinese workers demanding higher wages, it means the cost of manufacturing in China is rising, and the China price may be affected. But on the good side of it, we have a very imbalanced economic relationship between China and North America and Western Europe. An increase in domestic Chinese consumption should redress that. In a year when both Europe and America are going to be having very, very slow growth, increase in domestic Chinese consumption should also help to keep the Chinese economy growing faster.
Professor Stephen Tsang, director of the China Policy Institute at the University of Nottingham, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The gross domestic product figure is a measure of all the goods and services that make up a country's economy. And as Adrian said, in 2011, China's economy grew around 9.2%. Now, for comparison purposes, our economy was growing at a rate of less than 2% for most of last year. But as Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai, it's not really a fair comparison.
Some years, India's GDP growth runs neck and neck with China's. Sometimes economies like Paraguay's grow faster than China's. And according to economist Arthur Krober, here's why none of that matters.
What's significant about China is it's been growing at around 10% a year for 30 years in a row, which is the best growth performance that any country has ever had.
Any country ever. Back in its economic heyday 100 years ago, the U.S. economy was growing by around 4 or 5% a year. But Krober says that, too, is a dangerous comparison. That's because the U.S. was one of the first countries to industrialize. 100 years later, China finally got around to doing the same, and it inherited a lot of the know-how from the West.
So the later you come into the game, the more stuff you can just borrow or copy from the people who came before at very, very low cost. And that means that you can grow a lot faster.
But don't focus too much on growth, says Krober. Three decades ago, China's economy was small, but it was growing incredibly fast. Now, China's growth is starting to slow down, but its economy is the second largest in the world. So that means every percentage point of growth is worth exponentially more. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Now to Hong Kong, home to one of the world's 10 biggest stock exchanges and some of the world's shortest trading hours. As the BBC's Andrew Wood reports, those long lunch breaks are under attack.
It's not so much Occupy Wall Street as Occupy Lunchtime. Hong Kong's one of the few major stock exchanges in the world that stops trading for a midday meal break. It's a nice, leisurely 90 minutes. And some stockbrokers were pretty angry last year when it was cut from 2 hours. Now they've joined forces with unions and even restaurant owners to resist a further cut in March to just an hour. But its chairman, Ronald Arculi, says that the lunch break needs to be cut if Hong Kong's going to keep ahead of longer working rivals.
If we did not do it, I fear that we will lose some competitive edge.
In the film Wall Street, trader Gordon Gekko famously said that lunch is for wimps. Goodness knows what he would have made of Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, I'm the BBC's Andrew Wood for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to Washington, D.C. The House of Representatives gets back to business today after its winter break. And one of the first items on the agenda is raising the debt ceiling again. That's because the U.S. Treasury is again about to hit its borrowing limit. Now, the last time that happened, as we all remember, the political squabbling led to a downgrade of the U.S. credit rating. But this time, raising the debt ceiling should be a lot easier, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Republicans and Democrats have agreed to a little political theater in order to increase government borrowing without triggering another debt downgrade or stock market swoon. Members of Congress can vent their opposition to growing deficits. They can even vote down a debt ceiling increase. But President Obama can veto their rejection, allowing the debt ceiling to go up without congressional approval, unless opponents can muster a two-thirds majority to override the veto, says American University government professor James Thurber.
The far left and the far right are going to make this very hard to come together and come up with a solution.
If successful, this scenario allows another $1.2 trillion worth of debt, which should get the government through the end of the year. And Congress has agreed to pay for that increase with across-the-board spending cuts, but not until next year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today is the last day to submit public comments to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau on private student loans. As part of Wall Street reform, the government is looking at predatory lending practices. The Bureau has a new head with a new set of priorities. Richard Cordray was appointed by President Obama earlier this month. He joins us now. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So the first public probe from your office is into mortgage insurance and illegal kickbacks. Can you tell me more about what is at the top of your agenda in this new role?
Number one, we are going to continue with our already fairly robust Know Before You Owe program to try to simplify the terms and the statements that consumers have about credit card agreements, about mortgages, the home loan application that you fill out when you go to get a mortgage, and about student loans. Second, we have launched our non-bank supervision program.
Let me jump in here and ask, just can you explain what a non-bank is and why it's a priority?
Sure. It's any institution that's offering a financial product or service, such as a mortgage or a student loan or a payday loan or check cashing service, but does not actually have a bank charter. To a consumer, that's often not obvious. The non-bank might call itself a finance company or something like that. To most of us, well, that sounds very similar to a bank, but it might be subject to no regulation and therefore might be quite unscrupulous. So you can't have a market in which some people are regulated and some people aren't. It doesn't work.
Now, we keep hearing how tight credit is in the country right now and that it's slowing economic growth. Is there any chance that investigations from your office could exacerbate that problem?
I think that, frankly, if you look at tight credit in this country, the main reason it's tight is because we had a financial meltdown. The financial meltdown was caused by the fact that you had markets that were partly regulated, partly unregulated. They didn't work, and it led to a catastrophic economic ruin for many people in this country. If we can avoid that in the future, that's the best thing we can do to get the credit markets working for the long term and on a sustainable basis.
Richard Cordray heads the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We are just 4 days away from the presidential primary that could determine who the Republican nominee will be. I'm talking, of course, about South Carolina. Did you see the debate last night, Adrian?
I've heard parts of it. I didn't see it, but I've listened.
I was watching it from beginning to end, and one of the things I noticed that was interesting is, of course, Mitt Romney has quite a sizable lead right now in most of the polls in South Carolina and doesn't really want to get into any fights with anybody that might change that. And so at the beginning of every single one of his answers, wasn't every single one, but almost all of them, he would say, you know, I agree with Rick Perry about that. I agree with Rick Santorum. I agree. When you're in the lead, you must agree.
Well, good advice.
So far, the states that we've heard from in the primaries and the caucuses are New Hampshire and Iowa, which are two states that are actually doing pretty well economically compared with the rest of the country. But in South Carolina, the jobs picture is one of the ugliest in the country. 1 in 10 workers there can't find a job. And as Julie Rose reports, that's likely to be on the minds of voters this weekend.
You can find a pretty good sample of South Carolina voters in the parking lot of a dollar store these days. Nobody's willing to pass up a bargain with unemployment the way it is around here.
I have a master's degree, and I can't find a teaching position in South Carolina for anything. So,
Republican Katie Smith has been without steady work for the past 3 years. So, yeah, the economy is the big issue for her this election. But she's stumped about the primary.
I don't believe that there is a candidate that's going to do anything for our economy.
I just feel like there's no legit candidate that I feel like I can trust.
Hardly a ringing endorsement there from Jay Thurman, who's also a Republican. He's hung on to his sales job through the recession, but is worried about the national debt. The candidates are hitting all the right notes for South Carolina conservatives, promising to cut spending, limit regulation, and get people back to work. Polls show Mitt Romney in the lead, but more than a third of voters say they're still undecided or open to changing their minds before Saturday. I'm Julie Rose for Marketplace.
So if you look closely, Adrian, at the earnings report we got this morning from Citigroup, you'll find sentences like the following. Clearly, the macro environment has impacted the capital markets, and we will continue to right-size our businesses to match the environment.
And I understand exactly what that
means. Yeah, exactly. That's a nice way of saying the economy is not really that great right now, so we probably are going to have to keep making cuts. Well, Lucy Kellaway is a columnist for the Financial Times who compiles corporate mumbo-jumbo like that each year, and she joins us now from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us about some of the winners in your annual list of corporate spin.
Well, there was a nice topical one on the best euphemism for firing people. And I awarded this to Nokia, who got rid of 17,000 people, saying it was managing them for value.
They don't want to say they're firing them or they're laying them off. They say managing for value.
Yeah, I must say, if I'd been managed for value, that wouldn't make me feel any better.
All right, so what else? Who else won this year?
Well, I gave the overall award to Manpower Group for describing itself in a way that I defy anybody to say what the company actually does. It goes like this. Our $22 billion company creates unique time to value through a comprehensive suite of innovative solutions that help clients win in the human age. Don't you love that human age as opposed to what? The dinosaur age?
That's right. Lucy, let me ask you. Why do they do this? Why do these corporations speak in this jargony way?
Well, I think they partly do it because it's really infectious. It's like a disease. It's the way that teenagers say like all the time. Business people say going forward. But I think there's something else that actually nobody wants to get sued. No one wants to be held to account. So often if you're a CEO, saying nothing is actually makes rather a lot of sense. It's depressing, but true.
Lucy Kellaway is a columnist with the Financial Times. Lucy, thanks so much.
Not at all.
Hollywood may be getting a new labor union. After years of courting, the two main actors' unions have worked out a deal to tie the knot. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
The proposed merger would combine the Screen Actors Guild, known as SAG, with the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, or AFTRA. SAG traditionally represented film actors. AFTRA's members are television actors, as well as radio DJs and broadcast journalists. The merged SAG-AFTRA would negotiate for all of them. As the entertainment industry has evolved, the two unions have had a lot of overlap. Gary Chason teaches labor relations at Clark University's Graduate School of Management.
I think the key question here is why not merge? They share a large number of members. The unions are being challenged by new technologies in the industry. I think they see that they have a brighter future as a combined organization than they might as separate organizations.
Another effort to join forces failed 9 years ago. In 2008, AFTRA pulled out of a bargaining partnership with SAG and signed its own deal with TV producers. Chason says this time the push to merge is coming from members. The boards of the two unions will meet later this month to vote on the deal. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So, Adrian, have you heard of Cupcake Gate? This is this brewing scandal in which a cupcake was confiscated at the airport in Las Vegas because of concerns about its gel-like icing. It sort of didn't fit into the new national security liquid rules for getting things on planes.
Or a TSA agent was hungry.
Exactly. Well, exactly. The latest development from Cupcake Gate comes from Providence, Rhode Island, where a bakery has cooked up a cupcake to get through airport security. According to Time magazine, the TSA-compliant cupcake, as it's called, has exactly 3 ounces of frosting and comes in a clear quart-sized plastic bag.
Brilliant.
Now, of course, over the last few years, as we've been dealing with these liquid requirements to get things on planes, entire industries have been built on the 3-ounce packaging. And here to talk with us about all of this for our Midday Extra is Christopher Elliott, author and consumer advocate. Kitty's with us from Orlando. Hi, Christopher.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. So obviously we're used to having our pack of mini shampoos and little tiny toothpastes and all that in our luggage. Are there any other items that have sort of popped up in the world of tiny things you can get on planes?
Well, yeah. I mean, in addition to the cupcakes that you just mentioned, which sound really tasty, actually, there's the little bottles and anything that's, a lotion, gels because of the liquid and gel ban. But also now you have TSA compliant bags that, if you have a laptop, you can slide your laptop in there and they can send that then through the X-ray machine.
You mean you don't have to take it out of the bag?
You don't have to take it out of the bag. That's correct. You also have, novelty items like the TSA proof underwear, which you can wear into the backscatter or X-ray scanner, and then they won't be able to see your private areas.
Now, how big is this TSA-proof industry these days?
It's really hard to say because it spans several different industries. You have luggage, you have apparel, you have cosmetics. So it's impossible to say how big it is, but one thing is for sure, it is growing.
And these 3-ounce rules have been around for some time now. Why is it that people haven't quite figured out how to deal with them? I mean, when I go to the airport, it does seem like every other person has to open up their luggage,
dump
pull
something
out, you know, shaving cream or whatever they left in there and all that?
Well, people have known about this for a while. I think that the liquid and gel ban has been in effect since 2006. The enforcement is just all over the board. You have sometimes you'll get stopped and all of your liquids will be inspected and sometimes not. So I think people just don't know what is going to await them when they get to the airport.
Now, why do you think this cupcake story got so big? Why did it blow up like this?
Well, baked goods are always a big story when it comes to the TSA and usually around the holidays. So people are just waiting for the TSA to confiscate their pies and cookies and cupcakes. And so when this happened, it was just too delicious of a story.
Well, Christopher Elliott, have yourself a cupcake this morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And Adrian, you can have a cupcake as well.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I don't know how to make them, but
I know where to buy them.
Good. All right. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.